Welcome back to Feminist Book Club, the podcast. We're not just about feminist books. We are here for social justice, literature, and media in all its forms. But we do that through an intersectional feminist lens. Thanks for being here. Let's get started.
Hey, my dudes, and welcome to the Feminist Book Club podcast, the show that brings you the best of the best feminist content. I'm your host, Neba from Notes by Neba, and today we're going to talk about the science of truth serums with my dear friend, Bree. Brianna Barbu is a chemist turned science writer. Welcome to the show, Bree.
Glad to be here. I love an opportunity to talk about my nerdy obsessions with science and pop culture. So my background is in chemistry. I got a master's degree in chemistry last year from the University of Michigan. I research molecules that could be used to help store renewable energy. But now I'm a science writer, and I write about a lot of different topics, including plastic waste, particle accelerators, and boiling rivers. I'm also a huge book nerd. I read a lot of fantasy books because I love stories that bring fantastical elements into the real world or vice versa.
That sounds very similar to me, turning from scientist to person who creates stuff about science and absolutely love fantasy books. So I am really excited to have you here. So today we're going to be discussing the ins and outs of truth serums in fantasy and maybe in real life.
Who knows?
So truth serums. For those of you who are not familiar, truth serums in fantasy and sci-fi, as their name suggests, cause the user to tell the truth. Usually it's like a liquid that can be swallowed or injected. Sometimes it's a gas. Oftentimes in stories, it's taken against the person's will, like for an interrogation or because someone doesn't want to tell the truth. Sometimes it's even someone who's like trying to remember something about their past and they're trying to like, you know, use this as a means of remembering. So needless to say, it's a really interesting idea. And I was really stoked about it the moment that Bree brought it up.
Thanks. I'm super stoked about it too. The idea came out of a broader discussion about potions and poisons in fantasy. I published this really fun article in a magazine called Chemistry World about how poison works in Dungeons and Dragons. And it was so much fun that I decided to look into the chemistry of other fantasy substances. And truth serum was a really obvious choice to tackle because so many different fictional worlds have some version of it.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I think the concept of a truth serum has become something of a trope almost. So a couple of days ago, we sat down to think of all the universes that had a truth serum. And well, let's just say we'd be here for a few days if we'd really talked about all of them. So today we're just going to be highlighting some of the more popular ones.
So an example I think is really fun is this scene in Ant-Man and the Wasp, where the bad guys capture Scott Lang / Ant-Man's friend Luis, and they inject him with a drug to make him more suggestible and talkative to try to get him to reveal Scott's whereabouts. But of course, because it's Luis, who's already a really talkative guy, they get a lot more than they bargained for from their interrogation. Although they insist in the scene that it's not a truth serum. But later in the movie, they're injected with their own drug and left to the authorities freely confessing their crimes. And the one guy was like, oh, maybe it is a truth serum, which is hilarious.
Well, you really seem to know Ant-Man really well. It's almost like you watched it again recently or something.
Yeah, it's not like I just watched both Ant-Man movies again to prepare for this podcast on truth serum or anything.
Of course not. Well, I mean, even if you did, it's in the name of research. It's in the name vaguely of science.
I really like the MCU's knack, like / hate, the MCU's knack of taking real world science ideas and using them just correctly enough in the movies that you can tell that someone somewhere along the line did their research and then they or probably someone else took some creative liberties to make it fit into a world where superheroes are a thing. But yeah, the scene in Ant-Man is kind of actually how truth serums in the real world work more or less. They are drugs that lower people's inhibitions, so they're more likely to spill information than an interrogator wants.
You know, I hate to roll Marvel and DC together, but as a longtime Batman fan, I absolutely have to mention, you know, Batman also has some mentions with truth serum. In the very last episode of his animated series, Alfred gets dosed with the truth serum and somehow manages to resist.
Of course, because Alfred is a badass.
Yeah, he's got like a whole side plot line of just like being a secret spy agent and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But more interestingly, actually, there's this episode where Scarecrow creates a gas that renders people who inhale it like incapable of fear. So they don't have any fear of the consequences. And this doesn't exactly stop them from lying, but it does like remove any motivation for keeping any kind of like socially inconvenient truth to yourself. So people would like say and do all kinds of things they normally wouldn't, because now the fear of consequence is totally gone. And one of the interesting things that came out of this episode is that like when Batman fell under the influence of the gas, we learned that his code of honor against killing is driven more by like the fear of disapproval than by any actual moral inhibitions that he has against killing.
Oh, that's so awesome. So deep.
I mean, I think people like to think it's like, I don't know, that Batman is like this deep, dark character. But like, if you think that his like code of honor is just driven more by fear, it makes you question kind of like, I mean, it's a dude who dresses up as a bat. He's not exactly in the best mental state, which even he makes that joke quite a few times, but whatever, it makes for a really good story. You know, honestly, I wonder what I would say if I took a truth serum. I guess it would depend on what kind of questions people asked. So it wouldn't be an episode about truth serums if we didn't mention one of the biggest examples. And unfortunately, I think one of the biggest examples of truth serum comes from Harry Potter. It's super weird thinking about or mentioning Harry Potter in any way right now, after all of the sexist sticks that Rowling has said at this point.
Yeah, those books define my teen years. If you'd known me 10 years ago, I was a rabid Harry Potter fan. And I wish that the author had just bowed out gracefully from the public eye when the series was over and the movies were all done with, and just let them stand by themselves so I could still enjoy it and like reminisce about that time in my life when Harry Potter was the best thing about my life.
Yeah, I think you mentioned something the other day about this, about how like, you know, with Tolkien, at least he's not alive anymore and can't say just awful things about the world and like just sexist, racist things, et cetera, anymore.
His additional world building was more about creating like dead languages than tweeting. So.
Yeah, or writing like, what was it, like cursed, like writing plays that aren't even as strong as the original books. Yeah,
I could have written a better play.
Yeah, so in Harry Potter, it's probably like the quintessential truth serum almost. There's this thing called Veritasium, the classical magic truth serum. Even just having three drops is enough to get a person to reveal all of their secrets. So in Half-Blood Prince, one of the characters brews it as an example of like the type of potion that students should be able to make after completing like this particular like wizarding exam that they have.
But even Veritaserum has its limitations, right?
Yeah, totally. Like in, I think it was a Goblet of Fire, it's used on Barty Crouch Jr. And this guy is like impersonating someone else. And after he's found impersonating them, you know, obviously he goes through kind of this like trial slash like confession type period. And he says a bunch of things that aren't actually objectively true, although he believes them wholeheartedly just because he's not in that right mind. And because he's not in his right mind, they become, you know, truths to him. And we're going to touch on this a little bit later, this concept of like, what is truth? What is a person's truth? And that kind of thing. But for this reason, the potion is not allowed or admissible in wizard court, just like how polygraph tests aren't admissible in like our muggle court, so to speak.
So even though it does exist in that universe, the magical government says it's not fair to use it because it's not reliable, just like the real world.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the real world hasn't exactly been using the most reliable truth serums after for the long time either. Like for a long time, people just used wine. And I mean, I imagine that just got people drunk. But, you know, that, you know, as a chemist, I'm curious, like, maybe you can tell us, how close is the real world to a truth serum? Are there any drugs that would induce like a truth giving state?
So throughout the decades, plenty of drugs have been studied by intelligence agencies and such for getting people to reveal information that they otherwise might not be willing to provide. Those include things like ethanol, the, you know, what is in your wine making you drunk and a little more loose with what you say, and stronger drugs like scopolamine, benzodiazepines, barbiturates like sodium thiopental and amobarbital. LSD was even tried for a brief period in the 60s, which is a really fun story. None of those drugs have actually been scientifically proven with, you know, controls and peer review to compel people to tell the truth. They're central nervous system depressants. So what they actually do is slow the speed at which your brain processes higher functioning tasks like concentration or making stuff up or hiding information from people, which again is why ethanol, alcohol makes you tell the truth, it seems like.
Yeah. It's interesting that like it's just slowing your brain down, because it seems to be like these drugs are just removing any inhibitions that a person might have about talking in order to like make the person more talkative, even though what they're talking about may not actually be the truth.
Right. So what people say under the influence of quote unquote truth drugs is really more dependent on what they believe to be true or what they have an opinion about than what the objective truth is. When you're dosing someone with a truth drug, it's really going to more reveal the individual's personal truth about the situation.
It's interesting. I think, you know, this concept of like what a person believes to be true, it still will tell you like quite a bit of information as to like, you know, what this person in particular believes to be true. And this almost reminds me of this villain Azula from Avatar: The Last Airbender. In the show, she's able to lie super duper easily just because she firmly believes it to be true. And I don't know if she necessarily believes it to be true so much as just like she doesn't get fazed by lying. So like by not caring that she's lying, she's able to like pass all of these tests, which makes me wonder, like, you know, if someone is able to just change their way of thinking or change what they believe to be true, wouldn't they just be able to pass these like truth serums, all these drugs, all these polygraph tests and things like that? So, I mean, I think Azula definitely would be able to.
Probably the scariest thing about her is that she doesn't have any physiological response to lies. She's so cold. That makes her super interesting to me.
It's funny you mentioned she's so cold because she's like a firebender and like literally manipulates fire. But going back to like, I guess like governments and organizations in the real world real quick, are these places still using these chemicals even if these chemicals don't work?
Sadly, there have been plenty of recent examples of truth drugs being used. Although they don't reliably work and they're super, super ethically sketchy, they're definitely unconstitutional in the US and they're classified as torture by international law. These drugs still are used in various parts of the world. In 2008, police in India administered intravenous barbiturates to interrogate a suspect in a bombing in Mumbai. And as recently as 2012 in the US, a judge approved the use of sodium pentothal in the Aurora, Colorado shooting trial to evaluate whether James Egan Holmes qualified for an insanity plea. Although I couldn't find the information about whether or not they actually used it on him. It was just approved. That's all I know.
I know even just like approving it is also like kind of just this huge step, but you know, it's been like almost a decade, not quite. I did like a little bit of like research into this, and I saw that shortly after 9/11, the CIA also considered using this drug that it thought might work like a truth serum. So their idea was to kind of like force terror suspects to give up information about potential attacks. So there was this drug research program, Project Medication, which I think is just like the funniest name for it because it's so like benign and harmless sounding, but it's this like, you know, classified report about this drug called Verst, and it's this sedative that's usually used for anxiety, but the CIA is saying like, oh, it's maybe worth a try. In the end, they decided not to ask government lawyers to approve its use, and all these like classified reports ended up being released to the press. And I haven't found any more recent mentions of truth serum being used, but I feel like that kind of information would not even be public knowledge.
Yeah, I think if intelligence agencies are still studying truth drugs and trying to develop a truth drug, the work would be highly classified, so we wouldn't know about it.
Yeah, for sure. I think we can all agree that it's super unethical to use truth serums, but theory question here. If a truth serum did exist in real life, would there be any circumstances in which it is ethical?
So I couldn't think of any off the top of my head. I posed this question to my brother-in-law, who's a lawyer, and I love like asking him questions about ethics because he has really interesting answers. He said that the person taking it would definitely have to consent to it beforehand for it to be ethical. Like if you're suspected of a crime and you want to prove your innocence, you could ask to take a truth drug. Like, you could ask to take a polygraph test.
Interesting. I guess if you were taking this polygraph test, though, then, like, in a world where a truth serum did exist, then wouldn't it be kind of like a dystopia where people just thought you were guilty if you chose to not take the truth serum or, like, not take the polygraph test?
I could definitely see that happening, or at least being the plot of a very cool sci-fi novel.
Yeah, it feels kind of like a little bit of Gattaca vibes right there. Yeah, so two last questions for you, Bree. First, bringing it back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, the literary sphere as we will. First, what books would you recommend for our listeners?
So I just finished The Overstory, which is a super gorgeously written work of eco-fiction that I think you'd really like. And since I'm talking a lot about fantasy, I can't not recommend some more fantastical books. Ninth House is awesome. The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue was one of the best fantasy books I've read this year. And those both fit in my favorite niche of books that bring fantastical elements into a real world setting.
That sounds super cool. I'll definitely have to check out Overstory. I love all things fiction and I love all things plants. So it sounds like the perfect like blend of that. I recently just got Ninth House from the library too. So that'll be really exciting. As always, the links for and descriptions for all of these will be in our show notes as well, if people want to check those out. So where can our listeners go if they want to read more of your science articles or more about you?
So my personal website is brie-barbu.com. And that's got links to all of my published science writing. And I'm also pretty active on Twitter.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Brie. It's been awesome having you here. And thank you to our listeners. As always, my DMs are open to receive your feedback, questions, memes, comments, criticism, whatever. You can find me at Notes by Neba on every single platform, YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, Insta, whatever it is. And if you want to get a sneak peek into these episodes, we go live doing some of these recordings and sometimes doing talks and discussions on feminist topics. We go live on Clubhouse every single Wednesday at 4:15 p.m. Pacific time. So that is all we have for you to know. Thank you so much, and I'll see you on the next page.
Hi, all. I'm Mariquita Guerrera, and I wanted to talk with you a little bit about alternatives to well-known and well-liked books written by white men. Today, I thought I would offer up a suggestion for folks that are really into The Walking Dead franchise by Robert Kirkman, or even, as Renee pointed out to me, The Stand by Stephen King. The book I'd like to introduce to you is titled Severance, written by Ling Ma, published in 2018 by Fair, Strauss, and Giroux. And Severance has gotten some more attention in this last year because of the world in which it takes place, but more on that later. Severance follows the story of 20-something Candace Chen as she's in a place of transition in her life, between the uncertain responsibilities of adulthood and the freedom and agitation of her 20s. We meet Candace as she's joining up with a group of 8 other survivors of Shen fever, a plague which has afflicted the entire globe and has devastated the population. People afflicted by Shen fever often exhibit patterns of behavior which are familiar to them, as though they're on autopilot, stuck in a loop of a life they were once but are no longer living. The book deals a lot with nostalgia and the patterns that we find ourselves in, and what it means to belong to our present when we have so many ties to our past. And the fevered play this out writ large until they collapse from it. Our group of wayward travelers is making the journey across the country from the East Coast to the Midwest, headed towards the compound, supposedly a safe place where they can recover and try to rebuild. Partway through the book, it's revealed to the group what has motivated Candace to leave New York and to venture out on her own, the repercussions of which shift the locus of power and lead to a final showdown. Severance carries with it themes of rootlessness, of the meaning of home and belonging, and of nostalgia as a virus. Ma is able to incorporate so many of the classic elements of zombie stories and post-apocalyptic narratives. The journey, the search for safety and community, the charismatic leader, or in this case, the truly cringy and obnoxious leader. He thinks he's charismatic, but he may very well be one of my least favorite characters in recent memory. I apologize, that's a tangent. But zombies, it has zombies. Not exactly zombies, they're kind of zombies, they're zombie adjacent. They're animated dead, but they're not out for brains, you know? The suspense aspects of post-apocalyptic stories are not quite as overt here, although they are still present and there is still some gore, so be warned about that. Instead of the suspense, there's more of an emphasis on finding your way when you exist in the in-between spaces. It's a little bit deeper than just monsters, and it's okay if you just want monsters. Brain candy can be a welcome break, but if you're looking for something a little bit more engaging and monsters, you might want to pick up this book. As I mentioned before, Severance has gotten some more attention lately because it mirrors a lot of the aspects of our current pandemic. I first read this book in December 2019. Remember 2019? Before we realized how quickly the gears of the global economy could grind to a halt? Reading it again this year was eerie, and I had markedly different feelings about it. This isn't like when everyone was watching Contagion at the beginning of COVID. It's not feeling that sharp point of crisis and chaos. It's about how you fashion a life and the denouement of the crisis after the worst part has happened, and now you have to create a new normal, new routines. It's picking up the pieces. You can get catharsis from that validation, fatalistic as it may seem. There's comfort in watching someone else shift through the phases of the novelty of mask wearing, to the feeling of futility, to using it as a symbol for who you are and your state of mind. There's comfort in companionship, in the boredom, and in the malaise. Anyway, if this is your kind of thing, and by this kind of thing, I mean horror overlaid with a fine webbing of the quotidian, please do check it out. It'll be worth your time, and it's a pretty quick read at that. As always, we will link to it in the show notes. It's been a pleasure talking with you about Severance by Ling Ma. I hope to do a few more books on this theme and have a couple in mind, but if you have any recommendations, please feel free to send them over to me. You can find me on Instagram at @O_Murray, that's @O_MURRAY. In the meantime, forward momentum, my friends. As Candace says, the past is a black hole cut into the present day like a wound. And if you come too close, you can get sucked in. You have to keep moving. All the best.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of Feminist Book Club, the podcast. Want to be part of the club? Here's how you can join us. Obviously, subscribe to our podcast and leave a rating and review for brownie points. Follow along on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, and TikTok. All of those links are in the show notes. Sign up for our newsletter to be the first to know what our next monthly book pick is. And check out our award-winning monthly book subscription service. Oprah Magazine named it one of their favorite book boxes, and Shonda Rhimes called us one of her favorite subscription boxes in general. There are multiple membership levels for any budget, and it's an excellent way to support the show and the voices you heard today. See you in the club.
A well-read woman is a thing.